Blog Talk Radio.
Well, they say it's just a wolf, but I ain't never seen a wolf make those kind of prints before, and I ain't never seen no bear run on two legs. Yeah, there's some out there, all right. You make sure not to wander too far from the fire. You might not ever come back.
Was like at least, I would say, in between 8 to 10 feet tall. Because it was brown, it was hairy, hairy. I hunt for it, and I don't get freaked out by wood, dark, nothing, and that freaks me out.
You are listening to Bigfoot. Ground Zero. All right, my name is Dave. You're listening to Bigfoot Ground Zero. Thanks so much for tuning in tonight. I want to cover off on a couple of things. I got some correspondence recently via email. Again, you can reach me at bigfootgroundzero@gmail.com. And somebody had asked me kind of why I was doing what I was doing. Basically, there were a million other Sasquatch-related podcasts out there, and, you know, why was I doing what I was doing? And it kind of hit me like a ton of bricks, and I'll tell you why. I got into doing this. Obviously, I thought it was going to be a fun time. I love the whole idea of Sasquatch and the possibility of this thing being out there. And by the way, I'm 99.9% sure that this is the case. There are enough credible sightings out there, and it just goes without saying. But one of the things that I realized is I did not necessarily know why I had gotten into this. And it made me think, and it kind of made me step back and kind of take a second look at what I was doing. So I think tonight is probably going to be my final broadcast of Bigfoot Ground Zero. You wish. Now, what I found was I'd like to learn something. I think the best way to go about learning a topic is to teach it. And here's what I mean. You can come to the table with a vehicle like a podcast, and you can go out there with the knowledge that you do have, and what will happen is over time, other people's knowledge will come back to you, and it will make you that much more knowledgeable in whatever topic you're going for. So I think going forward, I'm kind of taking that spirit and moving forward with the show. I'll still have the opportunities to bring some entertainment where I can, definitely weaving in some of the Americana pop culture that goes around with Bigfoot, which we all love. We'll do the interviews from Ground Zero when and where I can get them. But we're always going to bring an aspect of scientific research or reasoning to the table. Because I think if you can combine all of those things, you'll have a program that is enlightening on the topic, but it's also entertaining. And to say that I'm not here to entertain would be a falsehood, because definitely, you know, you got to kind of do that in order to keep your audience and to keep engaged and to, again, keep learning. So I just wanted to bring everybody up to date on where I was with that. And it was a great question. And sometimes I hate when I get those questions that kind of rock my psyche and make me rethink what I'm doing and what my foundation is made of. But I think it'll be a little bit stronger, and it will definitely make for a better program going forward. As far as the interaction, again, people have been reaching me, and just the discourse as far as, knowledge. I mean, some really, really smart people have reached out. I've been able to ask questions on topics that I kind of never even knew existed as far as Bigfoot goes. And, if you wanted to pop in and ask me some questions or share any knowledge that you have, I'm at bigfootgroundzero@gmail.com. And I'm more than happy to get back to you. Also, if you go to blogtalkradio.com and jump into the show, Bigfoot Ground Zero, then what you can do is there's a little blue follow button. You can follow the show, and then whenever I do updates or I put out a new show, you'll get updates as they happen. You'll get alerts as to when the show is about to kick off, et cetera. Then you'll be able to join the chat room and that sort of thing. So the whole thing has been great. I've enjoyed the experience so far. I know this is only my third actual episode. The other thing that I didn't realize, and you think about this in your little tiny kind of broadcast world that you live in, when you put out a podcast, you don't realize that more than just a few people around you are going to hear it. I mean, there have been almost 1,000 downloads of the show so far, and it's just been a couple of programs that have gone out. And I'm kind of stoked about that, because some of the people that are downloading those and they're getting back to me don't live in the U.S. I mean, this is going around the world, and it's kind of cool because people in other countries have contacted me, you know, with questions. A lot of people already know what Sasquatch is, and there's a name for it in their country. And again, I'm learning this all the time. Today's show is going to focus on a couple of things. It will be focused around Sasquatch up in the great state of Maine. And I love that state. It's lush, it's beautiful, rich in heritage. We vacation there every year. There's a lot of reasons why I love the state of Maine. But I feel like New England in general, we don't get a lot of love as far as Sasquatch sightings go. So I wanted to take a minute during this program, actually more than a minute, and dive into some of the sightings that Maine has had over the years. And look at some of the ones recently. They've been the White Sasquatch or Silverback, also as they're known. So there's a rich history there. It goes back a long way. We'll cover off on that. But I've also brought Carl back, and he's been with us for the last two episodes. Carl is a really intelligent guy. And what he does is he looks at trends. He's a very analytical person. And he's put together a group of sightings in his neck of the woods. He's up in the mid-Atlantic region of the country. He's in Virginia. He found a spot in northern Virginia where there seems to be Sasquatch activity year-round, regardless of, you know, the year, the season, whatever. And it's within a very small radius, one to another. So we're going to go ahead and share that with you, why we think it might be a Bigfoot hotspot area. And then by all means, feel free to investigate. But again, be careful. Go with somebody. Because as much as we know and love and wonder about these creatures, you don't know for sure what you're getting into or stumbling on. So always be aware of that. So I will go ahead at this point, turn it over to Carl. We'll go ahead with the interview, and we will follow up from there.
Okay. Thanks, Dave. I got interested in the topic back in about 2008. I was going to work on the subway one day, and I found a city paper here in the D.C. area that had an interview with a guy in Northern Virginia, lived on the Culpeper between D.C. and Richmond. He had a sighting of Bigfoot back in the mid-90s when he was out doing some metal detecting for Civil War things in a field out near Culpeper. Changed his life. He, every spare moment, he was working on gear to find Bigfoot. So it got me interested. I had no idea there was Bigfoot in Northern Virginia, or sightings anyway. So I started doing some research. I found a couple of press articles from the late 1970s that talked about what they called the Mount Vernon Monster down near Mount Vernon, where George and Martha Washington lived, which is like maybe 7 miles from my house.
Sure. Yeah.
And then about the same time, late 70s, early 80s, there was a couple of sightings at Marine Corps Base Quantico, a little further south of my house, of what they called a monster, large, hairy, went over fences like they weren't even there, that sort of thing, scared the bejesus out of the Marine Corps sentries that were there.
Sure.
And so then after that, I found two websites that were more or less Virginia-specific in what they were cataloging for Bigfoot sightings. And so I started looking at areas or sightings that were within an hour and a half or so, two-hour drive from my house, basically north-central Virginia between Alexandria and Winchester to the north, and then maybe further south to an area north of Richmond, which is a circle about 60 or 70 miles in diameter and about 3,500 square miles. That's a big number. But if you're out there driving on the interstate or the state roads, it's really not that far. I can drive across that circle in probably an hour and a half, 2 hours.
Sure, sure.
And the websites I was looking at, I started putting them into a spreadsheet and then putting little pucks on a map to see if a pattern fell out. And I had, from this first stage of research I'm looking at, I have two patterns that are starting to fall out. I've got a North Central Virginia pattern, which looks like it takes place in the spring and summer months, because I found 9 fairly detailed, and I'll admit that I cherry-picked my sightings.
But Why'd you do that, by the way?
I was looking for sightings that had some detail to them.
Okay.
Something that said a little more than 25 years ago, my grandpa saw them on the side of the road in the middle of the night.
Okay, got to make sense.
I wanted something more than that. And I found 9 fairly interesting detailed sightings between 2006 and 2013 in an area between my house, Culpeper to the south, and Winchester out to the west. That's the 70-mile circle I was talking about.
Sure.
And there were several other sightings that didn't have the level of detail I was looking for, but there was another 3 or 4 sightings out there.
Can I ask a question while it comes to mind? Because I'll forget.
Yeah.
In these sightings, in the area, were these sightings on a perimeter, a defined perimeter, or was there a perimeter and then sightings in the middle of it as well?
A lot of them, if I get what you're asking, a lot of them seem to take place at or near roads, intersections,
okay,
roads, that sort of thing.
So my question is as people are seeing these things, it's not like, you know, you can find a specific place, but what you can say, and that's kind of what I was getting at, is are there man-made structures or travel ways that kind of go around the circumference of these things that would give rise to natural sightings? Does that make sense?
The spring and summer sightings that I found in this cluster, for lack of a better word, seem to happen near roads.
Okay. Okay.
And then I found what looks like, and I'm still kind of teasing out some details in the second batch, but I found what looks like a second batch in the winter months further west. And they look like a cluster of, from what I found, 3 or 4 good detailed sightings, and I'm still looking at a couple of other ones with not so much detail, but they take place a lot later in the year during hunting season, October, November, December, January, but they're way out further west in the Appalachian Mountains, where you wouldn't think you'd find these things, but most of the sightings seem to be from hunters out there chasing game around.
Okay, so that's perfect. So then that begs the question, are the hunters there at the time the Sasquatch are there chasing deer? Not that there's deer season for Sasquatch. Of course there wouldn't be. But are we seeing what's always there, but we're just seeing it at that time? Or is Sasquatch there at that specific time for that reason? I guess we'll never know the answer to that question.
That is the million-dollar question, because the sightings only happen when the people are there, but we don't know if Sasquatch is there the rest of the year.
And you would want to assume that would be the case, but you don't know for sure.
Right.
And, you know, we talked about this previously, and we talked about food source and that sort of thing. And here's what's one of the most frustrating things about all of this. I mean, we all kind of agree that people are seeing something. Sasquatch is probably real. I'd put 99.9% until we actually get a body. But I feel like there's one or two clues that if we could just get that tumbler to fall, everything else would fall into place. And that's a food source of an identified food type that they eat, because maybe they really are vegetarians, or maybe they're omnivores, or maybe they're carnivores. Like, we don't know for sure, but if we could just find that one food source, you go to it, and eventually they come. It's just like hunting deer or elk or anything else. For like an elk, you go to a site where there's a mud puddle, and it's hot, and you know they want to rub the flies off themselves, and they're going to go there, and then you shoot them, right? So it's almost that simple. Do you kind of agree with that, or am I being too simplistic?
If you can find that thing, you find the animal.
Okay, yes. So Carl, then what is that thing?
I don't know yet.
We're working on it.
I don't know what it is.
So what are some of the so you've gone through these sightings, right? And there's some probably memorable ones. Anything that sticks out in your mind as more credible than the others, or one that's just like, wow, that's interesting?
One of the more interesting actually took place not too far south of my house, a place called Leesylvania State Park in Prince William County in January of 2003. A man and his son were up for a walk in the woods in the park. They were on the way back to the car. Dad said, hey, I'm going to duck off the trail. I got to take a leak. I'll be right back. Son's standing there looking the other side of the trail and says, hey, Dad, what's this? And starts describing this large, hairy creature, but like a football player.
Right.
And the kid's like 8 or 9 years old, starts describing pieces of the anatomy that he really shouldn't be. You know, the eyebrow ridge, the head, the hair, the nipples, what the skin looks like. And Dad's sitting there taking a leak going, crikeys, what's my kid looking at? And by the time he gets zipped up and turned around, he's gone.
I know you are describing a serious situation, but first of all, when anybody says nipples, I laugh. That's just part of that. But secondly, you've got this hunter who is sitting there next to this tree doing his thing, and nature's call, and all of a sudden he looks up and sees Sasquatch. Do you think he went, I've got the wrong gun in my hand? I couldn't help it. You know me. I had to take it there. If you're listening, and I apologize for my idiocy. But, all right, so go ahead. I mean, so there was that sighting. Anything else that you can think of that really stood out? And it could be something related to patterns, you know, two or three of these sightings were this and that or whatever. It could be anything. I'm just kind of throwing it out.
Well, there was another one in one of the summer sightings not too far from my house.
Yeah.
A lady in late at night, her and her daughter went to pick up their son at Dulles Airport. They're driving home out near Manassas. She got lost, and not too far, which is kind of interesting. The area out near Manassas has been built up a lot over the last 10 years or so. And there's still been the last 10 years. There's been some interesting sightings out there near Manassas, but
sure.
She's driving home. It's 11 o'clock at night and makes a corner on this road where she got lost on and finds this tree log in the middle of the road, manages to go around the tree log. And then, you know, a little while down the road after that, her kids described this large, hairy, hulking figure on the side of the road. She didn't see it because she was busy making a turn, but she didn't seem to make the connection. You know, we've heard before about these things like to put logs in the road to sort of cut down on the traffic or say that this road is theirs.
Sure.
She goes around a log, and then a half mile later, they see this thing on the side of the road that's large and dark and hairy.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, those are tough to verify. I mean, I'd love to talk to this lady. There's a lot of roadside sightings. You still would, I mean, you would know the difference between a black bear and something huge.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And that's one of the things she said in her comments was, her kids were not describing what they thought was a bear. It was much taller. It was crouched over. It was on two legs. It was not it didn't look like a bear.
Sure. So what I'm gonna do is kind of transition, Carl, really fast. Ladies and gentlemen in the listening audience, Carl is going to join us as blogger on the site for now, but we've got two or three other people waiting, and we're going to have a series of blogs going on about this research and that sort of thing. We've set up a website, bigfootgroundzero.com, and again, it's going to be about research. It's going to be news feeds, audio, video, you know, that sort of thing. We will eventually have kind of a chat forum there in the near future. Idea being, while you're listening to the podcast, you can just go to our website and chat it up. And hopefully, you know, again, this is going to be research-minded. So any flutes and, you know, flute players and fruit basket people, you know, need not apply. You can listen, but we just don't go down that road. It's just kind of another camp entirely. And again, you know, Carl's research is great. He's going to keep bringing it to us, especially from the Mid-Atlantic region. If you need to get in touch with him, just do it through our email, which is bigfootgroundzero@gmail.com. Again, it's bigfootgroundzero@gmail.com. And I think that'll do it. Unless you had anything else, Carl, we'll go on to the main Bigfoot sightings.
Nope, nothing else here.
All righty, sir. We'll talk to you later.
Okay, thanks, Dave. Night.
Bye-bye.
All right, thanks again, Carl, for the insight on that. And again, if you're going to go check that out, I know when I did the Betty's Neck sighting here in Massachusetts, I actually had some people go by, like, immediately, within a day or two, and, you know, document some pictures, what they thought might be footprints and that sort of thing. So that was kind of cool. But I know people are listening for that. Again, just be really careful because you don't know what these things could do. Don't get lost. Don't put yourself in any weird situations. As far as Maine goes, what is it you think of when you think of Maine? You probably think of the shoreline, rocky shoreline, summers on the beaches. I know we vacation there every year for about a week in the interior of Maine. You probably think of lobster, clams, corn on the cob, clam bakes, that sort of thing. You probably don't think of agriculture, which is in abundance in the state of Maine. You might not think of the explosion in the culinary cuisine. There's a great movement going on right now, especially in and around Portland. You might not think of local artists, painters, and writers and that sort of thing. I mean, this is where Stephen King came from. So maybe it's not a stretch that Bigfoot is in Maine. I mean, weird things happen, right? But the state itself has quite a few sightings when it comes to Sasquatch. And these sightings come over the years. You know, from the early 1800s, Mount Katahdin in Maine, it's the largest mountain in the state. I think it's only eclipsed by Mount Washington in New England. But the Native Americans had sightings there for years and years and years before that, and we just started documenting those. And so what I wanted to do tonight was not only talk about these sightings, but draw the correlation of these sightings between the counties in Maine. There are 16 total, but some of the outlying counties are where these sightings come from, and I'm going to give you a reason why I think they come from that area, and it has to do with population expansion, and it'll make sense when I get into it. But we're also going to do the gratuitous reading of encounters, because we all need that, right? That's why we tune in. We love the encounters of Man versus Sasquatch, so to speak. Although they all ended well for the most part. There's one where a French fur trapper didn't, you know, make out so well, but that was the only one. So I want you to sit back, relax. The next 20, 25 minutes or so, we're going to go over this stuff. And again, when I'm done, if you have any questions, feel free to shoot me an email, and I'm happy to answer them. So I ran down to the lake. It wasn't more than 100 rods. Drawing the canoe out of the water, I stowed it away, bottom up, among the cedars at the foot of a low crag which overhung the lake. I was just coming away when I heard behind me the same queer sound we had heard at the island, and looking up, saw the beast man again, standing at the top of the crag. He wasn't more than 100 feet off, so I had a pretty good view of him as he stood out against the clear sunset sky. It was the same form and shape as before, fully as a tall man, and I could now see his face. Perhaps it was partly fear, but I did think it had a devilish look. There was a tuft of thick hair on the head, which lent a frightful expression to the face. If this was what the Indians used to see, I don't wonder why they thought it was the devil. I had my gun and slowly raised it as if to take aim. The creature raised its arm in the same way, but I had no thoughts of firing. I didn't dare to. And when I lowered my gun, the creature dropped its arm with another whoop. I know I was frightened, I will say that, yet I saw it plainly enough, and I could have sworn to its identity anywhere. The next day we started for the settlements, and that's the last we ever saw of it. And that is the last we ever spoke of it.
Bigfoot, Sasquatch, abominable snowman, Yeti, no matter what you may call it or if you believe it, no doubt you've heard the stories.
Well, but now a Maine man is claiming that he saw a white Bigfoot in Litchfield. He reported to Cryptozoology News that the quote, unquote, strangest beast terrorized him and his dog. WMTW News 8's Allie Miles headed to Litchfield to see what residents thought of this sighting.
The casts, you know, go from 1950 to 1967.
From skulls and figurines to a giant footprint, even some DNA-tested Bigfoot hair. Portland's International Cryptozoology Museum has it all when it comes to creatures that may or may not exist.
Some people just don't want to talk about monsters and stuff like that.
But that doesn't mean everyone wants to believe in Yetis.
Most likely, it's just one of the big hairy guys that live around here, roaming around.
The tiny town of Litchfield might not know it yet, but it's making headlines in cryptozoology news. In between stories of leprechauns stealing wedding rings and Birdzilla spotted in California, a Maine man told the online paper a white Bigfoot is roaming around Litchfield.
I wouldn't be surprised if there would be any, some in Maine, if there is any. Why not? I mean, you know, they're out and out west and all that, so... And they say there's some in Alaska and all over the place, so why not here in Maine?
Alas, after our search, we couldn't find even one footprint, at least one that wasn't mine.
So we didn't find any Bigfoot, we didn't find any Yeti, and we didn't find a Sasquatch, and you might be sitting at home thinking, I'm crazy. But the best part is, the museum's assistant director says, it's good to be skeptical.
It is not good to have no level of skepticism. You need to really look at what you have and kind of make those decisions on your own, what you determine to be actual.
But for those residents who didn't even know they could be hosting their very own beast, at least we got them thinking that maybe it could be true.
In the big woods, something is, I mean, we don't see everything in there.
Who's to say, you know? There might be something like that lurking around, but I don't know.
All right, now that first story that I narrated was from a book called Camping Out, and it's from 1872 is where I got the date. You can find that online. Just do a search, and it's at Harvard College. Actually, yeah, it's Harvard College. Check it out. It's a story. It's a group of young men that go out on an outdoor adventure, and even though it was years and years and years ago, people lived pretty remotely. They still went out to kind of get away from things. And you'll be surprised at how closely that book, when they talk about this devil man that they're seeing, resembles what we would call Sasquatch or Bigfoot today. The reason that I read that is because I wanted to kind of give you an idea. I kind of wanted to bring that book to life because I figured if I read it and it was obviously... detailed in a time where English and ideas were conveyed a lot differently, but you get the idea. It's the same kind of sightings that we get today. And then I wanted to bookend that with the recent sighting of Sasquatch in Maine near Litchfield. It happens to be one of those silverback or white Sasquatches that we've talked about recently. But it does kind of go, and the reason the story works out, it's timely. It ended, I think it was in February of this year was when the sighting was. Because I wanted you to see that there were accounts hundreds of years ago, and again, in and around Mount Katahdin that were actually detailed by Native Americans. And then we still have these sightings coming up today. And it's kind of nice to see that these sightings are happening in the here and now. It wasn't something that the last sighting was 2002 or 2005 or even 1998 or whatever the case may be. There's a bunch of those, and we'll just kind of chronologically go through those as the sightings, as the BFRO has laid those out, and then whatever else I can find. But when you think about that, and when you go to make your case for why Sasquatch and why you think it may be even up in Maine or along the eastern seaboard, you can point to things like that, because I guarantee you if you go do a search of Sasquatch sightings, just like the ABC affiliate out of Portland did this story, I guarantee you there's multiple. And I haven't done the search, but I'm willing to go out on a limb to say that that is the case. Side note, now I've been in the media business for about 12 years, radio and television on the advertising side, but I've known a lot of on-air personalities. And did you notice the sarcasm and condescension that was just dripping from their voices? I really wanted to reach through the computer and choke people, literally, because I feel like this is a legitimate, and again, it's not a hobby, it's a field, and we're all searching for answers, but every time we get some publicity, it's always like somebody's patting you on the head saying, there, it'll be okay, and it frustrates me to no end. Things are changing, and you'll see that more and more as these shows come out there. But when it comes to news reports and on-site, and they compare you to leprechauns and Thunderbird sightings and that sort of thing, then that puts you in the fifth dimension camp, and Sasquatch walking through time and space and this continuum and yada, 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 and he's flying with butterflies and he's got a wand and he helps you out. That's frustrating. But we did get to see the fact that they are covering it, and I do believe there's something to the white Sasquatch sighting that was just reported, only because it's been reported before. And I don't think these people wake up in the middle of the day or in the morning and say, you know what, let's hoax a Sasquatch, especially if they're not in the community. We all have our issues with some people who consistently see Sasquatch, but they never quite bring it out scientifically. I think this is a legitimate case and something to kind of think about, because again, these folks, they're not in the community. They have no, like I said, they have no reason to call a news station and say, hey, this is what I saw. Something motivated them to do it. And these folks live in and around the woods. Clearly it wasn't a bear, right? So anyway, that's that. All right. So what I wanted to do is talk about a theory that I have regarding population growth or explosion and Bigfoot sightings. Now, in many parts of the country, the population is what it is. I know parts of the Pacific Northwest, you know, there's a lot of logging. I think there can be, you can account for a lot of the sightings with loggers as they're pushing further and further out into the forest. And I think as you're doing the same thing in Maine, again, in northern Maine, it's literally nothing but logging roads and the Canadian border. Hundreds and hundreds of miles of these roads. And in the winter, that's what the snowmobilers will follow. But my theory is on this, is we're going to see more and more Sasquatch sightings. Maybe not dramatically, but more importantly, we're going to affect their habitat. And you can see it with the black bears in New Jersey over the last few years. They've had some real issues. And it's not too far-fetched to say that even though we don't know the true patterns of these creatures and we don't know exactly what they eat and kind of where they inhabit, you know, for 100% certainty, I do know that as you're pushing animals out, their behaviors will change. Maybe they'll become more aggressive. You're taking them away from their food, from where they sleep, from where they reproduce. Imagine if somebody took you and your wife out of your bed and said, okay, you got to go. I mean, you'd get pissed off too. And I think you're seeing here slowly but surely some of that happening. That's my concern kind of as we look at this and the population starts to grow. And certainly Maine is growing and certainly in areas where it was not as populated in the past. You know, more and more people are coming into the state. I can tell you that more people from Massachusetts and New Hampshire are making the trek up. And they get a little frustrated because they call us massholes, by the way. And Red Sox fans are getting to be as hated as Yankee fans. So, sorry, side note. Anyway, so what I want to do now is play for you. I found some clips on YouTube, and of course there are other news reports throughout New Jersey of what's happening with the black bears. Obviously, they're more in abundance, and it's on a different scale, But it's just something to keep in mind, because as we go through this, you'll figure, you'll look at, hey, it's natural that this would happen. If this creature exists, which we all think for the most part it does, it has a place to live, it has a routine, and it has a place to reproduce. And we're going to disturb it at some point if we aren't already, hence the logging roads out there and what's going on. But just take a listen to this, and as you're listening, think about, if you were a Sasquatch, you know, would this be potentially happening to you?
Deadly bear attack in New Jersey.
A 22-year-old man was killed while hiking in a preserve in West Milford. CBS's Tony Aiello reports. It's new at noon.
Don't entice them. Most of the time, they're skittish. They'll just run away.
Robert Eckert, shocked to hear what happened behind his home in the Opshawa Preserve in northern Passaic County. West Milford police say five young adults went for a hike on the last Sunday of summer, but only four made it out alive. 22-year-old Darsh Patel of Edison was mauled to death by a black bear.
From what I'm told, there's been very few bear attacks. And I don't think there's ever been a fatality, from what I was told.
The surviving hikers told investigators they encountered the bear in the woods, and it began to follow them. They grew frightened and ran. Hiker Darsh Patel may have twisted his ankle and fallen. He became separated from the others. When the survivors got to safety, they called police. West Milford Search and Rescue found Patel dead. A black bear nearby, the bear was euthanized.
It's pretty, I mean, it's scary because, you know, you got a lot of kids and stuff. You got a school right here. So it's, you know, it's something, I mean, you're not going to stop it. So it's really, it's horrible, actually.
Residents in this heavily wooded corner of Passaic say encounters with black bears are a constant in spring, summer, and fall. And the only thing a bear usually attacks is an unsecured garbage can.
I avoid them, and they're usually very skittish. As soon as they see a human, they're gone. They're very fast. They run probably 35 miles an hour. Very fast.
Signs at the preserve parking lot mention nothing about potential bear encounters. In a statement, the mayor of West Milford said the entire circumstances of this deadly situation will be reviewed.
Ironically, tonight here at the municipal building, a long-planned seminar on how to coexist peacefully with black bears. In West Milford, New Jersey, Tony Aiello, CBS 2 News.
And this appears to be the first ever instance of a black bear killing a person in New Jersey. In 2002, a black bear killed a baby girl from Brooklyn. The child was snatched from a stroller at a resort colony in the Catskills while her mother led other children to safety.
New Jersey's black bears are likely to be in the crosshairs again. Environment correspondent Ed Rogers has the story.
The State Fish and Game Council voted unanimously to adopt a new black bear management plan that includes a hunt after hearing the results of two studies. The first, a population estimate on the number of animals in the area north of Route 80 and west of I-287 had risen to 3,438 in 2009. A 2003 estimate put the population between 1,600 to 3,200. 4 years ago, the Corzine administration abandoned the hunt and adopted mostly non-lethal methods to control problem bears. Wildlife teams used black-mouthed cur dogs like these, rubber buckshot, and fireworks as part of aversive conditioning. The biologists say the bears that received the conditioning didn't return to the same site for 45 days. Bears that weren't harassed returned in about 18 days. But the research shows there were no long-term benefits.
Regardless of whether they're treated or not, they return to urban settings within 17 days. So you can keep them away from a site for a limited time, but you can't stop the behavior, and they do return to urban settings.
The number of reports of serious incidents involving black bears has risen from 130 in 2006 to 276 in 2008 and 255 last year. Animal rights groups blasted the move and say the state has not done enough to deal with people who store food and garbage improperly or don't use bear-proof trash cans.
Why is this a democracy and we get no voice at this council? You are all wildlife murderers.
Throughout 2007 and 2008, only four violations were written on the feeding ban law, costing taxpayers $111,000 per enforcement.
But state fish and wildlife officials say they have had a 98% compliance rate with people storing their garbage properly.
The laws that is written now requires a written warning, and we have given those, and most people comply then. We've only had a few occasions where people have blatantly continued to intentionally feed bears.
Several game council members are from South Jersey and say they're concerned about the number of incidents increasing in that area of the state.
I don't think that many people would want to see the densities they have in the northwest part of the state, which are creating all kinds of problems up there. And they also don't want bears to be relocated from the north to the south.
One interesting finding of the population study is that New Jersey's bear population is developing its own genetic character. Officials say they hope to reduce the bear population by some 300 animals. The hunt would be similar to the six-day seasons held in 2003 and 2005. The DEP commissioner would have the authority to stop the hunt if too many bears are being killed. If the DEP commissioner okays the black bear management plan, the state must still hold a public hearing on the hunt. The Fish and Game Council could give final approval to the plan by mid-July. Ed Rogers, NJN News, Upper Freehold Township.
All right, so that was a lot of audio from a couple of videos that I pulled off of YouTube. Recent news reports over the last couple of years of bear behavior and changing behavior in suburbs in New Jersey. Now, the first thing you want to be aware of, the first video, unfortunately, that 22-year-old Rutgers student was killed. He was with his friends, as you heard, and they just happened to come upon the bear. And the bear, for whatever reason, decided to go after them. One of the young men fell down, and it looks like that was his undoing, unfortunately. And, you know, I can't imagine going through life, living your life, and then all of a sudden realizing you're going to be eaten by a bear and wondering, you know, how the hell did I get here? And that's not a joke. I mean, I'm serious about that. I think when you go into the woods, just be careful. We're so used to hiking. We're so used to nature. But there's big things in nature other than Sasquatch that can get you. What's important about that killing, other than the fact that that young man unfortunately lost his life, is that that was the first bear attack, black bear attack, which that's all they have in New Jersey, where someone was killed in, I think it was 150 years, one of the videos was talking about. And it's interesting because it's only been over the last few years, probably 10 years or so, that population has been encroaching on black bear populations. Now, the population in New Jersey of black bears is already high. But as these suburbs push further and further out, we're seeing some really strange behavior from these black bear. And I went online, and I won't inundate you with all of the audio from different videos that I saw. But you see some crazy things. You know, you see black bear going into a neighborhood and jumping into swimming pools on a hot day in the summer. They're actually going into garages now, and the lady was attacked a few years ago. Fortunately, she wasn't killed, but she was attacked in her own garage. Now, the bears are blatantly walking down the street, and they're habituated. And I'm not going to go down the Sasquatch habituation thing. That's your own deal. But you know, they're used to humans, and now they've got a taste for garbage, and I'm sure small animals, dogs and cats that they catch and that sort of thing. But things are changing. Things are changing in the environment around us with a population of animals that is much larger than Sasquatch. And we don't know what a Sasquatch's true behavior is, but I can only guess as we push out further and further into wilderness, or what used to be wilderness, that behavior will change one way or another. They'll either run or they'll stay where they've always lived and fight back. And I think that's what we're seeing with the black bears. Their behavior is definitely changing, and I think it's because of encroachment. I mean, really, if you're looking at it, there's no other way to really say it, right? And I know I've gone off on quite a tangent, and I get that. And sometimes I will go into a podcast and I will change my mind midstream on what I'm going to talk about. And obviously some of this stuff I've put together ahead of time. But this was just an idea. It was one of those things that, and I have to look at some of these past sightings over the years and look at where the aggressive behavior came from. And I'm wondering if it is sightings closer to populated areas. And I don't mean a couple of blocks or, I mean, it could be camping grounds within a few miles of a major city, you know. And we are, you know, and they say about black bear or any bear, especially brown bear, grizzly, they will say that when you interrupt their pattern, like when they're eating or they're going to water or something like that, or you get between their children, then you're doomed. And I was talking with Sarah Brown. I know she and her husband do some great work. They've got potentially Sasquatches in their property. They live on a reservation in Grays Harbor, just outside of Grays Harbor in Washington. And I was talking to her the other day, and I've got to give her credit on this because it makes sense, but I don't think a lot of us think about this. We see Sasquatch when probably we interrupt their daily routine, right? So they're going to water, and we happen to get between them and the water, and we don't know it, and we're crossing a trail, and there they are. Or maybe they're going home during the day or at night or whatever to bed down, hang out with the clan, and we happen to interrupt them. You know, or maybe they're hunting deer and they see us and then they become aggressive and maybe we become, we're on the menu. Point being is we don't go out and seek, or they don't go out and seek human interaction. That would be crazy. It's probably even foreign for them to even think that. Even if you lay out a bowl of fruit, just saying. But I think you have to realize too, if you can kind of not even draw that conclusion, if that's even possible to think, if the two are related and you flip that around, well, we're kind of interrupting black bear patterns, right? We're changing their patterns. We're making them not what they were meant to be or who they are based on their habits and that sort of thing. So I just have to wonder, as researchers or, you know, armchair quarterbacks of, you know, Sasquatch behavior and that sort of thing, do we have to be aware that when we're pushing them out, are we not changing their behavior? And again, from a baseline, we don't know what that behavior is, but it's got to be something, and it's got to become more aggressive as we are encroaching, as we are pushing them out of their routine, as we are making them what they are not meant to be potentially. And again, this is coming from a guy who has not seen one. I've not spent any time in the field with one. But if I'm putting everything together, and in nature, if patterns follow patterns and there's a likeness or a sameness to these sort of things, it might make some sense. All right, that's the cue. Music has started. It means another show in the can. Episode 3, Bigfoot Ground Zero, Maine Sasquatch. Thanks for hitting us up in the chat room. Thank you for reaching out via email at bigfootgroundzero@gmail.com. My name's Dave. Until next time, over and out.
Carl says he's tired and he feels like he can't win. No matter how he tries to live, he never quite fits in. Bound and gagged and left for dead is how it's always been. He finds it hard to breathe sometimes when he finds it hard to swim. And Carl said, I wish I had someone to call my own and have my lover wait for me whenever I get home. I wish I knew what happened every time two people meet. Oh, the world is big, but I know there's nobody made for me. Becky lived in a one-horse town with ribbons in her hair, waiting for that shining night to take her out of there. And Becky never wanted any more than she could hold. She'd given up on finding love a long, long time ago. And Becky said, I wish I had someone to call my own and have my lover wait for me whenever I get home. I wish I knew what happened every time you speak for me. Oh, the world is big, but I know there's nobody made for me. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
it happened. They met out on the street. They both stood there in silence. They were both afraid to speak. So Carl, he stepped up, and then he gently took the hand of the lover he'd been looking for since before his life began. Carl said, I'm glad I have someone to call my own, and have my lover wait for me whenever I get.